Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and yesterday we did an Uncommon Economic Indicators call-in for immigrants, and we heard people who came to New York from basically every continent except Australia. Was our last caller there from Australia? I meant to ask him. But yesterday we heard people who came to New York from basically every continent except Australia, many of whom described the temptation to return to their countries of origin because the economic opportunities might actually be evening out. Like this listener, G from Harlem, with Medellin on his mind.
I'm a Colombian American, and I've been thinking about moving to Medellin just because I find that like opportunities down there seem like they're at the basically just it's ready for the picking.
Well, one reason some New Yorkers may be considering reverse migration is housing. It's long been one of the toughest challenges for immigrants to this high-cost city, and there was that stat that housing in Manhattan, at least, kept going up in 2008 despite all. And a report from the Pratt Center for Community Development surveyed more than 500 immigrant households in 2008 and found that a third of immigrants living in primarily immigrant neighborhoods, a third of those families, pay more than half their income just to have a roof over their heads. And that was just before the crisis hit in the fall. Now the survey director from Pratt says the map of foreclosures in New York City looks like a map of immigrant neighborhoods. And with us now are Brad Lander, senior fellow at the Pratt Center for Community Development. He's a longtime affordable housing advocate, and we should mention he's also running for city council from his neighborhood this year. And Javier Valdez, deputy director of Make the Road, the activist group working for immigrant rights, among other things. He did some of the field research for the Pratt Report. Thanks to both of you for coming on. Good morning.
Great to be here, Brian.
Brad, the basic stat about a third of immigrant families paying more than half their income, that's probably been true for a long time. What was new in your survey research?
Well, over the past few years, you know, prior to the economic downturn, rents went up at a much faster rate than before. And over the past 15 years, we've been seeing a lot more immigrants move to the city, especially those who came more recently, were just much more likely to find their only options to be to move into very high-cost housing or very overcrowded housing.
Javier, how did you do the field research for this report?
So we worked with the Pratt Center to help devise the survey, and then we went out and surveyed people in the neighborhoods that we work in. So we did predominantly surveys in Jackson Heights, Corona, and Bushwick, and we just went and talked to people face-to-face.
When did you actually do this? What months was this going on?
It was in the summer of 2008.
And what did you find?
Well, I think the main thing that we were finding, and Brad alluded to it, is that the rents kept skyrocketing, particularly in our neighborhoods, as gentrification became a bigger issue. But the wages of our members kept decreasing. And a lot of our members are in very vulnerable economic positions. And with the economic downturn, they have had to move in with other families or have to move to a more affordable housing that sometimes is under more precarious situations.
Do you think, Javier, that things have started to even out a little bit since you did the survey? 2008 was remarkable in the way you describe. It was a year when wages were already starting to fall, jobs were already starting to go away. But for those who rent, even as housing costs, you know, the purchase price may have been coming down to some degree, rents were still steady or going up. Now, with the economic meltdown, we hear that rents are falling around the city, too. Is it in some way actually making it easier for immigrants because rents are coming down now, even though jobs are hard to find?
I mean, I'd love in your uncommon economic indicators or anybody to call in to hear whether any rent-stabilized tenants have actually seen any rent decreases. My experience is that for the rent-stabilized stock, for those units renting at $800, $900, $1,200, $1,300, $1,400, all the landlords are still taking the maximum allowable annual increase, and that if we're seeing dips, it's in the unstabilized rental stock.
Well, that would be right,
at the top of the market.
I'm sure that's right. But the whole theory behind rent stabilization is that those rents are pegged to affordable caps in the first place, no?
Well, I mean, every year the Rent Guidelines Board decides how much they can go up, but if they decide they can go up 4% and your income doesn't go up any, you still have to pay more. I'm not saying that that doesn't work to keep rents more affordable. I just haven't heard of anybody, any working families in a rent, in rent-stabilized units actually benefiting from lower rents as a result of the declining marketplace.
It is an interesting question. You know, it even goes to the Ravitch Commission report about what they should do with subway and bus fares. They wanted to peg that to inflation if that plan goes through for the future. And I actually asked Richard Ravitch and, you know, got a chuckle, not really an answer. What if we're living in a period of general deflation, which we apparently are now? Would subway fares and bus fares actually go down? And I guess the same question could be asked of the Rent Stabilization Board.
They actually do have the power to make that decision, but I don't think we ever seen the Rent Guidelines Board ever say that there should be a decrease in the rents in New York City.
So this would be a very uncommon economic indicator. If anybody is a landlord or a tenant in a rent-stabilized apartment or knows of a rent-stabilized apartment where the rent has actually come down to reflect what's going on in the market, call us, 212-433-WNYC. Brad, you've said the geography of foreclosures seems to track the map of immigrant concentrations in New York. Give us some examples of that.
So last year, the Furman Center at NYU did a great look at where foreclosures were taking place, and they found a couple of very interesting things. First, that about half the families in foreclosed homes were actually renters. You know, they're in one to four family homes. So that was an interesting stat, that foreclosures in New York are impacting both renters and homeowners alike. But the top 10 neighborhoods include, you know, Jamaica, Bushwick, East Flatbush, Parkchester, East New York, a number of places where immigrant households, both as owners and as tenants, are predominate.
And tenants may also suffer from what you call predatory equity, investment by corporate landlords in immigrant housing. We've done segments on this before, but remind our listeners, Javier, you're on this, right? What is predatory equity?
Well, these are landlords that we're looking to buy into the housing market, and we're looking at ways to get in and try to make those units in that market as market rate as possible, so they were then pushing out as many of the rent-stabilized tenants as they could. So we actually saw a lot of that in Queens here. We have a big campaign working with against the predatory equity landlord Vantage. But also to what Brad was saying earlier regarding the foreclosures, it's also affecting the smaller units. So in Bushwick, where the housing stock sometimes is smaller, five to six families, a lot of these landlords have to foreclose, and they have a lot of tenants that live in that, and they're pushing them out as well.
So this predatory equity, just as in the more publicized cases like Stuyvesant Town and Riverton, where landlords bought a top dollar in the rising market, hoping to jack up the rents in those stabilized apartments by getting turnover, kind of encouraging people to move out, and then the vacancy decontrol would allow them to jack it up to market rates. This has been happening with Vantage and other companies in many smaller buildings in less well-known areas. But if those landlords, Brad, are feeling the squeeze of a deflating rental market, is that a silver lining? Does that help the tenants now?
Well, we'll see. One of the problems there is that, like the banks, like so many places in the economy, they borrowed far too much. They purchased these buildings with a lot of debt. And so if they can't achieve the rents that they were expecting, they're most likely going to go into foreclosure or bankruptcy. Mm. Now, maybe that'll stabilize the rents and the pressure that was being put to harass and get higher rents or to evict existing families to bring in more wealthier ones will abate a little bit. But, of course, there's always a risk in foreclosure or bankruptcy that conditions will go down as well.
Right. So, now, we did a segment based around Paterson, New Jersey, which has a high floor closure rate, on the rights of tenants in New Jersey, which has pretty good protections for tenants renting in homes that are foreclosed upon as long as they keep paying their rent. What rights do tenants in New York have along those lines?
Well, it's a big difference whether they're in rent-stabilized buildings or not rent-stabilized buildings.
Uh-huh.
So if you're in one of those predatory equity buildings, but it's a multifamily building, you're covered by rent stabilization. Even if you're in foreclosure or bankruptcy, your rent stabilization rights survive. And so you have some of the strongest protections, tenant protections in the country. If you're in a 1-to-4 family home, you're not covered by rent regulations, and you don't automatically have the right to stay. A few lenders, I mean, this is one case where Fannie Mae has done a good thing. They made a very clear policy. If renters are in buildings that they hold the mortgages on and they continue to pay their rents, they'll allow them to stay.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really in the hands of the receiver or whoever winds up with the property in foreclosure.
Javier, just before you go, since you work so actively in immigrant communities, what was your reaction to the clip of that caller whose tape we replayed, who's considering moving to Medellin, Colombia? He's Colombian American. Are you seeing reverse migration taking place in some of the communities you're working in?
So the bus has picked up, and I've been hearing a lot of that from our membership. A lot of people are now considering, should they stay here? Is it a would it help them economically and their family to stay in the United States, or should they consider moving back? I have not seen a large move to do so, but there has been more buzz and discussion around it.
Any certain countries where the buzz is the highest?
Usually the countries that are closer to the United States, so predominantly Mexico and Central America, has been the biggest buzz.
Javier Valdez, Deputy Director of Make the Road New York. Brad Lander, Senior Fellow at the Pratt Center for Community Development. Now, Brad, where, for full disclosure here, what's your city council district that you're going to run in this year?
It's in Park Slope, Carroll Gardens, Windsor Terrace, Kensington, out in Brooklyn.
All right, well, maybe we'll have you back later in the year with your opponents for a full-fledged candidate interview. Thank you for coming on this report.
Thanks so much for inviting us.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, coming up in a minute. We begin a three-part Month of March series with economist Simon Johnson. Today, we will ask why Ben Bernanke is bailing out the shadow banking system, the securitization of mortgages that we thought got us into this mess. Stay with us.